I have the whole night to unwind.
And do a little self-care.
The only way I know how.
I'm gonna watch a murder show, I'm gonna watch a murder show. Netflix, Showtime, HBO, and Daylight. Murder show, I'm gonna watch a murder show. YouTube, Hulu, that's my favorite thing to do.
Twin sisters got killed on a cruise in the...
Okay, I admit it, that is me. I don't just spend my working days on murder cases from the past and then podcasting about them. I also spend my free time listening to true crime podcasts and watching true crime television shows. And yes, watching TV shows about true crime podcasts. A recent favorite is Only Murders in the Building on Hulu, which lovingly pokes fun at true crime podcasters with a near-perfect accuracy. Let's just say it's a bit of a mirror held up to us about things that we don't even really notice. Like this.
Look, every great episode two always makes you care deeply for the victim.
That's true. I've fallen in love with so many dead people.
Either they make them sympathetic or sexy or interesting, none of which I feel for Tim Conan.
Look, so. Someone in this building had to have known him. We find that one person and all this cracks open.
That's Martin Short playing the character of someone who has just started their own true crime podcast. At first I laughed about this, but then I stopped and I took a look at our past seasons. Dang, our second episodes are usually about the victim. Martin Short's character was right, but just not exactly for the reasons that he thinks. Yeah, it's important for the victim to not get lost in the story of the crime, and it's also important to humanize them for the audience. Perhaps most importantly, from an investigative perspective, the reason you want to know all about the victim is because therein may lay clues to the crime itself. In this case, knowing who Sharon Johnson was and what was going on in her life behind closed doors may likely be the key to solving her murder. In law enforcement jargon, this is called victimology.
Victimology, in its simplest terms, academically, is the study of crime from the perspective of the victim's role in the event.
That's Sarah Kaline, who has been helping me investigate this case, and you'll be hearing from her throughout the series.
I am a criminal investigator. I work as a cold case consultant on homicide cases, particularly ones with a serial component or a sexual predator component to the homicide. I sort of ended up in this after about 10 years as a regular patrol officer and then a sex crimes investigator. And I left that after a decade and went into academic research to study criminal psychology, criminal behavior, again, with a concentration on serial predation. And just over the last few years have started taking all of that together and using it to help other agencies or to help private entities like families or, you know, media entities to reinvestigate cold case homicides. Victimology, when we speak of it in terms of a specific case, like out of an academic setting, the victimology is the examination of the factors in the victim's life that made them a more likely target for this particular offense. And this is where I want to be as clear as possible. This is not in any way a means of placing responsibility or blame on the victim. It's about understanding as much as possible about the victim. Because if you are searching for an unknown perpetrator, then knowing as much as you can about every minute aspect of the victim's life, especially in the time frame immediately preceding the offense, that will help you narrow down your focus on potential suspects. When you really examine a victim's life, you may find clues buried deeply that lead you to suspects you literally would not have found in any other way. I mean, victimology is a class that you take and sometimes a series of classes that you take in forensic psychology or in you know, criminology majors, because it's so important to understand the world of the victim if you're going to try and find out who entered that world. Any case that I work on, I always start with the victimology, and I want to know the victim as deeply as possible.
Okay, to be fair, there are random crimes in which the victims happen to be a target of convenience for the perpetrator. Victims whose lives couldn't really tell us anything about the person that hurt or killed them. But in this case, there's nothing random about the crime. Sharon Johnson's jewelry was left by her body, so it wasn't a robbery. There was no evidence that she had been raped, so she wasn't a random victim of a sexual predator. No, nothing about this crime was random. Everything we know tells us that Sharon was specifically targeted not to be robbed or raped, but to be killed. That's why we have to examine what was happening in her life and take a close look at every person that was part of it to figure out who might have wanted her dead and why. And so, our episode 2, as in past seasons, is about our victim. I have no problem with only murders in the building being right. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 2 of The State versus Jason Carroll. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
I mean, her family was, you know, a stand-up family from a small rural town. They were very well-respected people in the area.
We could say that we loved Sharon. She was a wonderful person and a great friend, very generous.
She was such a loving and giving and kind person. She was just so supportive. She never judged me, you know, no matter what I was doing to screw up my life, because I was pretty messed up for a long time. I spent my whole life healing my life, but because, you know, I was so screwed up back then. But she was always supportive and never judgmental and always really sweet and giving and kind. And I mean, of all the friends that in my whole life, I'd have to say, even to this day, she was probably the best friend I ever had.
I knew her well enough to know that I didn't think that she would put herself in harm's way. So whatever took her to that construction site, she believed whatever she was being told, because I don't think that she would have done that on her own if she felt she was in harm's way.
On the evening of July 28th, 1988, Sharon Johnson left work in Amherst, New Hampshire, to run a few errands and then return home to her husband, daughter, and stepdaughter in the town of Bow. She was halfway home that night, but never made it. She was found the next morning, strangled and stabbed to death, her body left at a construction site in Bedford, just 6 miles from where she was last seen alive. She was 36 years old. Sharon was a New Hampshire native, born and raised in Goffstown. She graduated from the local high school and went on to earn an associate degree from the New Hampshire Technical Institute in 1971. Sharon was an engineer at heart and driven and ambitious. She returned to college later in life to earn a Bachelor of Science in Techno-Business, graduating the year before she was killed at the age of 35. She'd kept busy between degrees, working in the field of engineering, first as a technician, and then as an engineering assistant, a position she held since 1974. That was around the same time that she had a daughter, Melanie, with her live-in boyfriend Gary Gage. They stayed together for 10 years, but in 1982, Sharon met an intriguing man through her favorite pastime, bowling. Kenneth Johnson, a carpenter, had moved from Rhode Island to New Hampshire in 1979 and ended up in Sharon's bowling league, where the two had not just hit it off, they fell in love. Gary moved out of Sharon's house, and it really was her house. She'd bought it independently, and Ken moved in. A few years later, in June of 1985, Ken and Sharon got married, but the marriage didn't sit well with everyone.
She told me she wanted to marry him, and I didn't think it was a really good idea.
That's Kathy Hampson, whose name comes up time and time again in the early days of the investigation as someone that was very close to Sharon.
She started dating him, and I sort of put up with him because she was so in love with him. You know, it was one of those kind of situations where it's like, okay, you know, and I remember the day that she came up to me and she asked me if I would stand up for her because she was going to get married. And I was like, I was trying to talk her out of it. I'm like, why are you doing this? You don't have to do this. You know what I mean? It was one of those kind of situations. She was my best friend. We hung out all the time. Well, I knew her because we worked together. We worked at a company, Harris Corporation. We were both computer technicians. She was obviously the ace, and I wasn't that great at it because I had just got out of school. So she was just really helpful to me. And we just got to the point where we hung out all the time. I went up to her house all the time. I stayed over. I drove back and forth with her to work. I mean, I think I stayed with her probably equally as much as I stayed home. We were really close. We spent a lot of time together. I don't know why she fell for him so hard. I remember telling her that because I was her best friend and she wanted me to stand up for her, I was very clear to her that I'll stand up for you because you're my best friend, not because I believe that this is a good thing for you to do. I just blatantly said that to her. And I meant it. I just remember every time I was around him, it was always just this feeling of tolerating him. That's the best way I can describe any time that I was around him. He knew on some level that I just tolerated him. Do you know what I mean? Like, how could I hide it? I mean, I'm about as transparent as glass. You know what I mean? So if I don't like somebody, I have a hard time to hold in or try to pretend that I don't. So it was a very understanding thing between he and I that I tolerated him. You know what I mean? For her benefit. And he knew it. He knew it. You know, I can't say at this point that he didn't know it.
Sharon came to the marriage with her daughter, Melanie, and Ken also had two daughters from his first marriage, Lisa, his ex-wife's daughter, whom he'd adopted at a young age, and Julie, a biological daughter he had with his first wife. At the time that Sharon was murdered, Lisa, 17 years old, had recently moved back to Rhode Island to live with her mother. The two younger girls, Melanie, age 14, and 7-year-old Julie, who was only visiting for the summer, were home. And while it was already a full house, Ken and Sharon both wanted to have a baby together. Years earlier, Sharon had undergone a tubal ligation in order to prevent pregnancy, but she had the surgery reversed in 1986, and by the end of 1987, she was pregnant.
At one point, there were seven of us that were pregnant.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was really kind of weird.
Including Sharon?
Including Sharon.
Was this a pregnancy that she went when she was murdered? Like, was she pregnant then?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah,
oh, man. Oh, man.
But seven of us were pregnant at the same time.
That was Deborah Stengel, the wife of one of Sharon's co-workers, Robert Stengel. Sharon clearly made friends easily because dozens and dozens of people the police interviewed told them that she was a good friend, and no less than five women identified themselves as Sharon's best friend. Many of Sharon's friends were her co-workers, who were nearly all men, and their wives. In the case of the Stengels, they socialized outside of work and were even part of a bowling league together. Sharon would just drop by their house after work once in a while, and both women were excited as their pregnancies progressed. Given the effort it had taken to conceive, it was certainly an exciting time for Sharon and Ken. Ken, especially, was both hoping for and expecting a baby boy, a fact that he told investigators multiple times. It seemed as if the pregnancy was going fine, but according to Ken, there had been issues. When Ken called the police on the morning of July 29th, 1988, and reported that his 7 months pregnant wife was missing, the dispatcher asked if she was having any problems with the pregnancy. Ken responded, "We've had a lot of problems, you know. We've had a lot of complications." However, Sharon had last gone in for a checkup with her OBGYN only 6 days before the murder. And her doctor later reported to police that her pregnancy had been proceeding just fine. It turns out she had absolutely no complications at all. It seems that Ken's perception of the pregnancy or even the marriage didn't always line up with reality. When asked early on by the police what their marriage was like, he told them that they didn't have any problems and, quote, never fought. But that wasn't what others had reported. According to Sharon's father, a close friend of Sharon's named Tammy DeSalt had visited the couple a week before Sharon was killed. Tammy described Ken and Sharon as not getting along at all. Lucy Holt, who was married to another co-worker of Sharon's, remembered the same thing.
They had vocal arguments all the time, always sparring. It became less of bickering. It wasn't really bickering. It was more like, he's going to have his way kind of arguments. But she was telling my husband that she was hoping that a baby would make them a little bit closer.
If having a baby was supposed to help, it didn't seem like things were getting better. If anything, they'd gotten worse. Kathy Hampson, who saw Sharon multiple times a week, told investigators that in the weeks leading up to Sharon's murder, Ken had been very mad at her and avoided physical contact with her for a while.
I got together with her, and she was telling me that they were fighting and they weren't getting along very well, and I think it was even hard for her to tell me, even as good a friend as we were. All I remember is she told me that he was really, really angry at her and was, you know, yelling at her and kind of went storming out kind of situation.
Kathy knew things had been bad between them, but Sharon didn't tell her specifically why. Ken, said Kathy, was incredibly possessive of Sharon, calling her over and over when she was out with family or friends. This habit of Ken constantly checking up on Sharon was reported by others as well. Sharon's parents and brother and sister-in-law told the police that anytime Sharon was visiting them, Ken would call repeatedly to make sure she was where she said she'd been. In fact, Diane Eaton, who was married to Sharon's brother, said that if Sharon stayed 5 minutes past how long she told Ken she would be when she was visiting them, he would call looking for her.
For these and other reasons, Ken wasn't particularly popular with Sharon's friends. And to be clear, their entire circle was Sharon's friends, not Ken's, who may not even have had any. Jeffrey Shattuck was another old friend of Sharon's, and at one time they also happened to be romantically involved, long before she met and married Ken. While Jeff and Sharon only dated briefly, they continued to stay friends and, in fact, were so close that they both bought homes within a stone's throw of each other. According to Lucy Holt, the homes were so close you couldn't hiccup in one house without hearing it in the other. Meaning if anyone knew anything, it would be this neighbor. Jeff eventually married a woman named Linda, and Sharon married Ken, and they remained next-door neighbors until the Shattucks moved away in May of 1988, a couple of months before the murder. In a police interview taken 10 days after Sharon's murder, Jeff and Linda both reported that Ken and Sharon fought a lot. Linda told the police, quote, "I suspect Ken of having killed Sharon. He is very violent and has a bad temper.
He could get an anger thing going. He was just, it was like a person on edge, like a person who you really wanted to be wary of, like a dog on a chain. You know, you just didn't know which way it was going to go."
That was Lucy Holt again, and she echoed to us a lot of what others have said in police statements from decades ago, and also today, that they sensed Sharon was afraid of Ken.
She was having the baby, and I wanted to make something, so I made her a little afghan for the baby.
Oh, wow.
He wasn't there at this moment. So we sat in the living room. She was across from me, right directly across from me, and I gave it to her, and she unwrapped it, and she really, really liked it.
She gathered it up against her belly, and then she stood up and dashed into the kitchen and looked out the window. It looked like she was scared to death. And I couldn't, what's going on? And I said, are you okay? And she came back, and she, you could see that she was forcing herself to relax. And she says, yes, yes. She says, I'm all right. I thought I heard something. And I looked at my husband, and I said, yeah, she's afraid that he's coming home, and I don't know why. I have not a clue yet. And when we went out, I kind of asked my husband if we should ask her if she wanted to come home with us.
Even folks who hadn't known Sharon for long, like Carlene Webb, the employee who called Sharon's house six times to convince Ken to call the police, got a similar sense.
There was something not right about the relationship. And she, like I said, she didn't share a lot. But what she did share, and you can read body language, I thought, why is she afraid of him? You know, I could tell that she was uncomfortable. I definitely could tell that.
It's apparent from both the police reports taken at the time of the murder and in our own interviews taken recently that Ken seemed to give off a bad vibe. Not a single person said that he was a friend or even friendly with them. Sharon was their friend, and Ken was just kind of around. But despite the heebie-jeebies Ken gave people, no one ever said that they saw him act violent towards anyone. And no one ever said that Sharon ever said that she was being abused. Though there is, however, one police report of a coworker who remembered Sharon coming into work once with a side of her face black and blue. But Sharon explained it away by saying she had gotten hurt while helping Ken split wood. That wood splitting thing was only the latest in a series of business ventures that Ken had attempted to launch, which came on the heels of a failed t-shirt printing business. Given what people had to say about Ken, it is mystifying as to why Sharon married him and stayed with him. Everyone considered Sharon to be driven and smart, the only female engineer in a male-dominated field, and once she was even the only engineer in the entire company. Ken, on the other hand, was rarely gainfully employed and spent many of his days at home drinking. When Sharon married Ken, her own sister Peggy refused to take part in the wedding, and instead sent Sharon a sympathy card. To the outside world, Ken had married up, way up, but apparently Sharon didn't think so.
One thing that really surprised me that she shared with me about her relationship with her husband was she said she was surprised that he picked her. Yeah, she was surprised. She said, I feel very fortunate. You know, I don't feel that I'm, you know, the caliber of person that he would typically pick. So I was shocked by that because she was such a nice person. You get a sense, you can read the body language when mm-hmm. someone's talking to you. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like the few things she had said about, she felt like she wasn't deserving of him. She didn't feel she was worthy of him. Why did he pick me?
It's hard to know if Ken told the police their marriage was great and they had no problems because he actually believed it or because he was covering up for something. But there were, in fact, two major challenges to the relationship that nearly everyone that knew them reported. Their first problem was Ken's older daughter, 17-year-old Lisa, whom he'd adopted when he was married to Lisa's mother. Ken had raised Lisa since she was a toddler, and he was the only father she had ever known.
So he's my adoptive father, you know that, and my biological never was ever in my life, kind of sort of is now, but still, you know, only because I'm an adult and I can call him, which I do periodically once in a blue moon, but he was, I loved him, he, you know, to me, he was my dad, you know what I'm saying, like the only dad I ever had, and I never, you know, I mean, we had our arguments too, but he was always very calm, especially with like me. I mean, there was one time we were in an argument and I had a glass and I threw it, which I thought was going to be the wall, and I hit a sliding glass door and it shattered. And he just kind of looked at me, and I'm like, all right, I'll go to my room. I knew it was Sharon that I was going to really catch grief from because, you know, Ken wasn't really a big disciplinarian or anything, you know?
Lisa had been living with Ken and Sharon after her own mother kicked her out of her home in Rhode Island a number of years earlier. Unfortunately, she didn't give Ken and Sharon an easier time.
There's one report in which you say to the police that there was a time the year earlier, a year prior, that you hated Ken so much you wanted to light him on fire, like pour gasoline and light him on fire.
Wow. I can honestly say I definitely don't even remember that.
You don't remember that?
Raina, you're barking at yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. My dog sees herself in the sliding glass door. Goofball.
That's adorable, actually. That's okay. Don't worry about it. So you don't remember
that? I honestly don't remember that. I mean, very well could have said it because I know I've said terrible things to, you know, both my parents and, you know, at times. And, you know, I wasn't always the nicest young girl. Yeah. I had a potty mouth and kind of still do.
Everyone close to Lisa, and even some not that close to her, like coworkers, knew Sharon was struggling with her stepdaughter. Shouting matches, fights that got physical, including the time that Lisa allegedly pulled a knife on Ken, threats of self-harm, skipping school, disappearing at night, hanging out with unsavory characters. Lisa was putting her parents through all the motions of a teen acting out. Sharon sometimes felt that Lisa was jealous of the attention that Ken gave to her, and thought of her as a wicked stepmother. Though today, that's not how Lisa remembers her.
Sharon was very, very good to me. You know, didn't treat me like a stepchild. You know, treated me like a child. I adored her. You know, we had our arguments. You know, I was, she used to call me queen shit because I was a teenager and thought my shit didn't stink. You know what I'm saying? You know, young teenage girls and, you know, I remember it was my job to do laundry during the week, and I got $20 for it.
Sharon tried her best to make things work, even engaging a professional to help the situation. Therapist notes from February of 1987 show that Sharon and Lisa were getting counseling together, and they illustrate how fraught the situation was. Lisa's behavior was affecting and influencing Melanie, Sharon's daughter, and Sharon herself felt less and less able to handle the stress. Sharon shared an incident with a therapist in which she lost control and broke down Melanie's door during an argument. Sharon was particularly worried that Melanie would follow in her stepsister's footsteps and become sexually active at a young age. She had recently learned that Lisa had gotten pregnant when she was living in Rhode Island and then terminated the pregnancy, the very incident that got her kicked out of her mother's house. Sharon hid this information from Ken, though, afraid of his reaction. Her own reaction was telling, though. Sharon told the therapist when Lisa admitted to the pregnancy, Sharon yelled at her, "I'm supposed to be having a baby, not you." The family was spiraling, and Sharon told the therapist that she was planning on having her tubal ligation reversed because she believed if she had a son, it would bring them all together. Sharon got pregnant later that year, but her joy was overshadowed by other news. Lisa was also pregnant again. That's when Sharon gave Ken an ultimatum. Lisa had to go. Otherwise, Sharon would kick both her stepdaughter and husband out of the home. In April of 1988, when both women were 4 months pregnant, Lisa moved back to Rhode Island.
Having Lisa out of the house may have brought some relief to Sharon if it wasn't for the other big issue she was facing in her marriage. One she didn't even bring up to the therapist. Ken had a serious and long-standing gambling problem. Dozens of people recounted Ken's gambling issue to the police. Some of Sharon's co-workers knew about it, their bowling buddies knew about it, her close friends knew about it, and her family knew about it. Sharon had been a victim of Ken's gambling addiction more than once, including times he straight up stole from her to pay off people he owed. And so Sharon had issued another ultimatum to Ken a few months before her death, that if she caught him gambling again, she was done with him. Which begs the question again of what Sharon saw in him in the first place. The possible answer appeared multiple times in the records in many, many statements people gave about what Sharon and Ken's relationship was like. To be honest, I just didn't really recognize it as the answer to this question until one of the people I interviewed told me straight up that Ken was the only man Sharon had ever met that could sexually satisfy her. Now look, this may seem like a salacious detail, and believe me, you should know by now that we wouldn't bring up anything like this for a gratuitous thrill. And as I read the case file early on, I pretty much ignored the dozens of references to Sharon and Ken's sex life, skimming over them, until the significance of that aspect of their relationship finally dawned on me. For now, though, let's put a pin in that.
One of my superiors directed me and another investigator to report to our troop barracks that Ken Johnson was going to be coming in for us to ask him about the homicide. Well, he called them Noonies, N-O-O-N-I-E-S. Noonies meant meeting her for sex. It's the only time I've ever heard that term was this case, Noonies. Because she got out of work at noon, and that's what they did.
That's Thomas Sexton, a former state trooper, describing what Ken told him was the last time he'd seen Sharon. Sexton had been tasked with responding to the missing persons report that Ken Johnson made on the morning of Friday, July 29th, 1988. When he arrived at the Johnson residence around 1 p.m. to take the missing persons report, Sexton found Ken and his 7-year-old daughter Julie on the deck of the house, both in tears. Ken was so morose that he couldn't even look up as Sexton approached, keeping his eyes on the deck. Sexton found Ken's behavior odd, to say the least. It was as if Sexton said in his report Ken was in mourning and that he already knew his wife was dead, though no one yet had identified the body found that morning as Sharon Johnson. After all, Sexton was just there to take a missing persons report. Sexton also found it strange that Ken never asked him what the police were doing to try and find her, or if there was any progress. In fact, Ken didn't ask Sexton any questions at all. Ken sniffled through tears as he told Sexton he had last seen Sharon the day before, when he had lunch with her in her car outside of her workplace in Amherst. Sharon, he said, had been working at the digital company for the past 4 months, and Ken said he was self-employed as a deck builder. After Ken got home, he heard from Sharon around 5:30 p.m., when she called to tell him after finishing up work, she was going to cash in a $40 Megabucks ticket at a shop in Tingsboro, Massachusetts. Thursday nights are often Sharon's night out, the night she likes to go shopping with friends, in particular with Kathy Hampson, and she usually got home on those nights between 10 and 11 p.m. Ken told Sexton he'd waited up until 2 a.m. for Sharon and then fell asleep on the couch. When he woke up, he figured that Sharon had already left for work. It wasn't until her colleague called to say that she hadn't arrived at work that Ken realized something was wrong. He called Kathy Hampson at 10 a.m. to see if Sharon had been with her the night before, but got no answer. Sexton then probed Ken, asking if he knew of any reason that Sharon would voluntarily not come home. Were they having marital problems, he asked? No, responded Ken. They have no problems, they never fight, and they didn't fight when he met her for lunch the day before either. The girls, Melanie and Julie, had gone to Sharon's brother's house the night before, leaving around 6 p.m. Sharon's brother was also named Ken, Kenneth Eaton, so to keep things less confusing, we'll refer to him as Eaton. Eaton and his wife Diane lived a few miles away, and the girls set out on their bikes that afternoon so that Diane could take Melanie to her weekly Weight Watchers meeting. They got back around 8:30 p.m., Ken told Sexton, but he wasn't home when they returned. He'd gone out too, leaving the house around 7 p.m. to browse a hardware store, and then the Bedford Mall, returning home around 9:30 p.m. He never left the house after that. Ken reported that Sharon drove a 1985 four-door green Subaru, and the only other car they owned was his own blue Subaru, which he pointed to on the driveway. When Sexton looked over, he noticed that Ken's car was caked in mud all around the bottom and lower sides of the car, and some mud was even on the roof. Sexton's report ends there, but the police weren't even close to done seeing Ken on that day. Once they'd positively ID'd Sharon's body, they had to return to tell the family that she'd been found deceased.
Detectives Davison and Murdock arrived around 4:40 that afternoon to break the terrible news to the Johnsons. They found Ken sitting on a driving mower outside. Sharon's brother, Eaton, was also outside with Ken, and the two girls, Melanie and Julie, were in the basement. The detectives followed Ken inside to a bedroom, where they showed him a Polaroid picture of the woman who'd been found at the construction site that morning. Ken nodded, positively identifying the woman in the picture as his wife, and threw himself onto the bed face down. He lay there, crying and choking, unable to say a word. But one of the detectives noticed something weird. It looked to him like Ken had stuck a finger in his mouth, making himself gag. Ken didn't say a word to the investigators for a good 40 minutes, until he finally made the comment, "We were going to have a baby. It was going to be my son." A little while later, Ken broke the news to the girls. Both began weeping, and Melanie lashed out, pointing a finger at Ken, screaming, "Don't you come near me, I'm not your daughter." Detective Murdock was able to calm Melanie down and took her outside on the deck to talk to her. She told the investigator that she'd last seen her mother on Wednesday evening, nearly 2 days prior. Things had seemed normal at dinner that Wednesday night, and she hadn't noticed any changes in her mother's attitude or behavior. The next morning, Melanie had woken up late, and her mother had already left for work. That evening, she and Julie rode their bikes to their uncle and aunt's house so Diane could take her to the Weight Watchers meeting, as she did every Thursday. Her uncle drove them home around 9 p.m., but the house was empty. Ken arrived home between 9:30 and 10 and asked the girls if they'd heard from Sharon, but they hadn't. Melanie told Murdock how much she loved her mother and how much everyone had been looking forward to the new baby. Ken wasn't her real father, she said, but he treated her mother well. Next, Detective Murdock spoke with Sharon's brother, who was still at the Johnson house. Eaton had gotten a call from his father telling him that Sharon hadn't returned home the night before, and he'd come right over to his sister's house. When he arrived, Ken's parents were already there, sitting on the deck, their faces sad and drawn, like they were at a wake. Ken was pacing back and forth in the deck nervously, and Eaton asked him what he could do to help. Ken told his brother-in-law to drive around and see if he could find Sharon's vehicle. She liked to shop at the Bedford Mall at the Mall of New Hampshire, and was probably there the night before. Eaton knew Sharon's car like the back of his hand, and he'd done plenty of mechanical work on his sister Subaru in the past. Eaton took off around 1 p.m. to search for Sharon's car, and spent a couple of hours driving through every area of the parking lot of the Mall of New Hampshire to look for her car. This might sound daunting, but the lots were mostly empty since it was the middle of Friday afternoon, and the crowds wouldn't hit until later in the evening. Eaton couldn't find Sharon's car anywhere, though, and at that point, neither had the police. As Murdock interviewed Melanie and Eaton, Detective Davison was still inside the house, and Ken made calls to inform others of Sharon's death. That's when Davison's ears caught something and stayed with him. He heard Ken Johnson telling someone on the phone, they, quote, found her nude. That wasn't a detail that had been provided to Ken. In fact, no details at all were provided to him. Ken hadn't asked detectives a thing. Not where his wife's body was found, by whom it was found, when it had been found, or even how she'd been murdered. It was odd enough that both investigators noted it later in their reports. Interviews complete. The detectives hung out a little longer until family members came to pick up the girls. And New Hampshire State Troopers arrived to tow Ken's blue Subaru, still caked in mud, to the crime lab.
Ken was summoned to the state police barracks in Bow that same night to be interviewed one more time by officers Gary Kimball and Thomas Sexton.
I specialized in talking to people, so they asked me to just to sit in and run that initial interview. And we didn't even consider it to be an interrogation at that point. because from what I'm told is, from what I recall is, they simply said, you know, find out what he knows, where he was at the time, what they had done the previous 24 hours, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone told me he was a suspect at that point. But of course, you know, the husband always has to be a suspect initially until you can rule him out.
Sexton's report details Ken's personal background, noting that he was born in Providence, Rhode Island, where he was also raised. He moved to New Hampshire in 1973 after dropping out of college and then lived with his parents in Milford. Over the following few years, Ken moved back and forth between New Hampshire and Rhode Island several times, depending on where he could find work. But he had been settled in the state now since 1979. For the past year, since 1987, Ken had worked only part-time after having back surgery that he never quite recovered from. Ken had been working for Audley Construction as a laborer earlier in the year, but in the few months leading up to Sharon's murder, he had been self-employed. There was a ton of new construction happening in the area, and Ken took contracts to build decks on new homes. On the day that Sharon disappeared, Ken again reiterated that he had swung by her work to see her, which wasn't uncommon for him. Many days, Ken told the investigators, he would visit his wife during her lunch break, and they'd find a remote spot in the area, like a gravel pit, to have a midday quickie.
From what the sister told me, Sharon was so, in the sister's words, oversexed that she made Ken leave whatever deck he was building every day to meet her for lunch so that they could go out into a sand pit or wherever and have sex every day. In other words, she couldn't wait till the evening, till they both got home. The sister confirmed that with me, or told me that. And the sister also said that when she asked Sharon, why are you marrying this guy? Sharon said to her, because he's the only guy who can satisfy me. And I don't know if it was the same sand pit or not, but every day they were going somewhere, according to what Sharon allegedly told her sister, to have sex.
On the day that Ken had last seen his wife, he had first checked out a sand pit for their noon dalliance before heading to Sharon's workplace. That pit, he said, was muddy and wet, and that's how he got mud on his car, he told the officers. After arriving at Digital, Ken parked his car and then got into Sharon's car to wait for her. He was still waiting for Sharon when someone else he recognized came out of the building. Billy Joe Thompson, who Ken used to work with years earlier, was now working at Digital, and her car happened to be parked right next to Sharon's. Ken and Billy Joe chatted as he waited for Sharon, who finally took her break at 11:45 a.m. Billy Joe left as Sharon got into the car, and then another Digital worker named Sean, who was taking his break, popped over to say hello to the couple too. Sean told the police that the day prior, Sharon had told him that Ken wanted Sean to help him with some construction work. She told Sean to come talk to Ken during her lunch break the following day, and that Ken would be expecting him. And that was why Sean went over to their car. Ken, however, paid no attention to Sean at all. Instead, Sean had ended up interrupting a tense exchange between the couple. Sharon was teasing Ken about how engaged he'd been in his conversation with Billy Joe. And Sean said that Ken turned red, gripped the wheel tightly, and responded in an angry tone that Billy Joe was just a former colleague. Once Sean left, Ken told the police, him and Sharon shared pork chops for lunch, they kissed and hugged, and then she went back to work. That day, there just wasn't enough time for a noonie. While we can't be sure of how often Ken swung by for these trysts with Sharon, we do know that he was always there on Thursdays. That's because Thursday was payday, and more than one person reported that Ken always collected Sharon's paycheck and deposited it himself in their joint account, which he admitted was what he did that day as well. Ken had stopped at the Indian Head Bank and deposited the check before returning home around 3:30 p.m. Both of the young girls were out, but they came back home soon after him. Ken read the paper and watched TV, and then he got a call from Sharon at 5:30 p.m., telling him that she couldn't leave work for another hour, and then she was going to go cash her lottery ticket. Melanie, he said, had called her aunt to ask about getting a ride to Weight Watchers, and then both of the girls took off on their bikes at around 7 p.m. Ken said he left the house as well to go buy a new construction level at Grossman's Lumber Supply in Manchester, about 25 minutes away. But then when he arrived at the store, he decided not to go in. Instead, said Ken, he went to the CVS at the Bedford Mall, about 10 minutes away, at around 8:30 p.m. to look at greeting cards. He left the CVS around 8:45 p.m. and stopped at another store on the way home to buy cigarettes. Ken said he arrived home around 9:30 p.m. to find that the girls had already eaten dinner, but there was no Sharon. He asked them if Sharon had called, but they said no. Melanie and Julie went to bed around midnight, but Ken said he stayed on the couch waiting and then eventually fell asleep. Ken told Sexton that he had a few rum and cokes because he was trying to calm down. He had never hit Sharon, he said, but he did yell at her when she was late in the past. The next morning when he woke up at 7 a.m., he went out to get the paper and noticed that Sharon's car wasn't in the driveway, so he assumed she had already left for work. A couple of hours later, he got the call from Carlene Webb telling him that Sharon had never made it to work. He said he called the state police after talking to Carlene, and then he went to drive around to see if he could find Sharon. It was a quick trip, though, and he didn't check any side roads. He returned home after buying a newspaper, after which Carlene called a few more times, and then he finally called in the missing persons report. The reason he didn't call earlier, he told Sexton, was because in the past he had called to report issues with Lisa and had just gotten the runaround. Ken mentioned a friend of Sharon's that the police should check in with, Kathy Hampson. He didn't like her very much, he told Sexton. She was too forward and always talking about her boyfriends. Towards the end of the interview, the police asked Ken if he knew why Sharon might be in the Bedford area where her body was found. But Ken could offer no reason at all why Sharon might be in Bedford, although Ken himself had just admitted in the same interview that he was at the Bedford Mall the night his wife was killed in that little town. Ken's interview lasted only about 2 hours, and really it was just an interview and not an interrogation. But Thomas Sexton really didn't get a great vibe from him.
We kept an open mind, but as soon as we started talking to him, the other detective and I, we knew that he knew about this. He was just way too cool. He never said to us the typical questions. Do you have any leads? Do you have any suspects? Or can you promise me you're going to find her killer? She was pregnant with the unborn child. I mean, he expressed nothing. He was just so cold about the whole thing. We were pretty taken aback by that.
Do you think he could have been in shock or something?
No, he wasn't in shock. No, this guy was very lucid. That made me suspicious. He didn't show any emotion. It's like he was trying to provide an alibi, saying where he was. For the last, I started doing this at 21. I'm 72. For the last 51 years, I've been doing investigations. I've done so many and so many interviews in my lifetime. I'm lucky I can remember anything about this particular case. But the main thing I remember is me and Kimball interviewing Ken Johnson, and that he was just cold. Not shock. He was just cold.
At the very end, Ken was asked if they had permission to search his car and was advised that he didn't have to give it, but Ken gave it anyway. He might have regretted that later, though, because the list of evidence seized from his car included the following: vacuum sweepings, soil samples, a receipt from Sears, a man's gold wedding band, and a utility knife. Next time on Undisclosed. If you have any information related to this or any of the cases we cover, remember you can reach us on our phone line at 410-205-5563. Once again, that's 410-205-5563. As always, a big thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme music, and of course to Meetal Thelhan for keeping the ship tight and the ball rolling as our executive producer. A special thanks to my research assistant Jennifer Leahy and her mom, and homicide investigator Sarah Kalin, who spent way too long in a car with me driving around New Hampshire.
Last summer.
Really?
Yeah, you're going left on Glendale, so I think it's the next one. Where literally the house, oh my god, the house was so disgusting, and the only thing that was clean in the entire, like, was this spot behind a couch that had a bullet hole in it, and like, the, I mean, the house was absolutely revolting. We're turning right here.
But that was spotless. That corner was spotless.
I lied to you. It was the next one. Okay. Yeah, though, that corner was spotless, and there was, like, there were huge, like, Costco-sized things of bleach on the counter, and nothing else in the house had been cleaned in, like, 10 years. We're like, I think we call that a clue. Yeah, that was a wild one.
Well, did they get him?
Yeah, that one, the problem was there was no body. And we would not have been able to get it until one of the guys who killed him, the girlfriend, came forward and told us where he was buried in a bayou down there. And they would have never found him otherwise, so they wouldn't have been able to do anything.
A bayou.
Yeah.
Let me tell you where we are. I'm not the best driver, but you know.
Okay, this is job done.
So cute, as I. Yeah.
The brick walls, yeah. Yeah, in about a mile, you're turning left on Bodwell. It's very close. This is a good little loop, yeah.
It will make it in time for the Spangles, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Even we can hit, like, Cumbies or something for you to.
Yep.
Actually, I'll probably do as well.
I drank so much water last night. Mm-hmm. I'm not used to talking this much. I think, especially in the pandemic, I just talk to people. So yesterday, I was like, oh my god, I talk so much to Sarah. I'm dehydrated. We talk nonstop. Jason, I have, like, no friends in my, like, actual, like, social circle that I see regularly who are interested in crime at all. Do you know what that's like? It's like, nobody wants to talk
to me. Nobody wants to talk with me. They really, I have one good friend who's like, please, like, seriously stop, it's upsetting. I'm like, all right. My two best girlfriends that were okay, one is just an avid true crime fan, and the other is a coroner. Our little group, we're
see, I have
all
friends
we're like,
in the industry.
Yep. We're like, let's talk murder, ladies.
Yeah. And none of my friends, like my close, again, the ones I see on a regular basis, my family socializes with, listens to podcasts or knows anything about it. So it's like, I have, like, that's why I had so much to talk about with Rebecca last night. I'm like, oh my god, this.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like, they have some vague notion of what you do. Like,
listen, no, this
I think
happened.
She's on the radio.
I swear to God, 3 weeks ago, my dad gets in the car, and it's so cute because he's
her dad is so cute.
He's such a teddy bear, and he goes, Berta, which means like daughter. Oh, I'm sorry, where am I going now?
You are going left on Bodwell in a quarter mile.
Okay, left
a little less than a quarter mile.
He gets in the car and he's like, I want to ask you something if you don't mind. I'm like, okay. He's like, how do you make an living? What do you, I don't, he listens to my podcast. I mean, he doesn't follow all of it. He doesn't understand all of it. There's a lot there.
Going left here.
But he's like, that's what it was. He's like, well, how do you actually get paid for what you do?
Yeah. Who is sending you money to the radio? And do they make the check out to radio?
He's like, because I listen for free. So how are you
Yeah. I love that he's very worried about that, but also didn't want to pry.
Yeah. And I'm like, and he waited years to ask. That was my favorite part.